Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Peter M. Reyes, Jr., Judge Kevin G. Ross, Judge Randall J. Sleater, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2020. We have six cases on our calendar for today. This is our second oral argument. As you know, we are following Minnesota Supreme Court rules to have arguments heard virtually versus in person. We certainly prefer to have the in-person arguments, this technology seems to be working. Hopefully it'll work without a glitch today as well. We thank you for your patience and your cooperation in terms of having these arguments in this way. I know that both of you are very familiar with our rules, so I won't go through those. So, Counsel for Appellant, feel free to proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Deontay Lawson. Mr. Lawson has raised three issues for this court's consideration. The first challenges the sufficiency of the evidence on the venue element. The second challenges the jury instructions on the venue element. And the third challenges two of the heinous elements used to impose a life without release sentence. Given the way that appellant has framed this case versus the way respondent has framed this case, in a way, this really comes down to a choice of law. So I'd like to begin with State versus Pierce. State versus Pierce is the law that should apply in this case. And under State versus Pierce, Mr. Lawson's conviction should be reversed. State versus Pierce, which is cited in appellant's opening brief, is a published opinion from this court in which this court assessed the sufficiency of the evidence on the venue element and held venue is an element of every criminal offense. Venue must be proven by the state beyond a reasonable doubt. And the way the state establishes the venue element is by proving that any element of the charged offense occurred in the county. So Pierce uses the any element test. That is the test that applies here. And under that test, Mr. Lawson's convictions must be reversed. Pierce is interesting because it's an order for protection crime. And in Pierce, the state failed to establish either the location from which the defendant sent the communications that violated the order for protection, nor did the state establish the location at which the victim, the woman who had the OFP, received the communications.
But counsel, isn't that where this case is different than Pierce? Because we do have, it is established where the crimes started. And it went through a number of different counties, but we, at least three counties, it looks like from the record here, but it at least started in Hennepin County, didn't it? We know that, right?
I would agree that the kidnapping started in Hennepin County. The standard in Pierce is whether any element of the specific crime that we're talking about, so the criminal sexual conduct offenses, occurred in the county. And that is what the state failed to prove. They had to prove any element of those crimes, the criminal sexual conduct crimes, occurred in Hennepin County. It's not enough to prove that the entire behavioral incident started in the county. That's not the standard.
How do you distinguish the Daniels case from your case? And I know you did in your attempted in your reply brief, but I'm looking at the syllabus point of the court in Daniels. When there is a course of criminal conduct that involves separate crimes committed in more than one county, venue is proper in a county in which an operative or triggering event occurred. Isn't that essentially the language that the judge used in the jury instruction here?
That is the language the court used mostly in the jury instructions here, but that language was incorrect, and Daniels does not apply. Daniels is not about sufficiency of the evidence. It doesn't define the venue element. It doesn't consider jury instructions. Daniel is about the location of a trial. So it's critical in distinguishing the Pierce law versus the Daniels law to understand that venue trial location and the venue element are distinct concepts. And this court—
Wouldn't you agree? I'm not trying to understand the distinction. Wouldn't you agree that, and perhaps it's not disputed, that if the jury instruction is incorrect, then there is insufficient evidence with regard to that element? But I don't understand that to be the issue. The issue, literally, as you pointed out on your second issue, I believe it is, that the venue instruction is incorrect. So if it's correct, there's sufficient evidence. If it's incorrect, there's insufficient. Would that, on that issue, would you anticipate that Ms. Burdorf may agree with you?
She may. You'll have to ask her. I would say that certainly this court, it seems to me, this court has to begin by deciding which law applies. And once you've made that decision, I believe the conclusion would be the same for both issues. I think there's a small possible chance and figure out whether you could hold one way on issue one and a separate way on issue. I think it's tough, not impossible, but I understand Your Honor's position that they sort of dovetail in that way. Once you decide which set of law applies, permanently, it seems to me the outcome will be the same on both issues. Did that answer your question?
I believe so. And so are you essentially indicating that we can, based on our facts, ignore Daniel?
Not ignore, Your Honor. It simply doesn't apply. Just like law about entrapment doesn't apply here and law about discovery doesn't apply here, Daniel's is not about the venue element. So in cases called Blue Flat and case called Eibensteiner, both of which are cited in my opening brief, this court has said quite clearly, explicitly, that trial location and the element of venue are different. In fact, this court used the word distinct. And it's notable that in Pierce, so Daniels was decided before Pierce. So in Pierce, this court is sitting with Daniels as relevant precedent. It had been decided. And in stating, in holding that the any element test is what we use to assess whether the state has proven venue beyond a reasonable doubt, this court didn't cite Daniels. Didn't talk about Daniels. That's because it's inapplicable here. That's about where to hold a trial. And in Daniels, the language is also quite clear and quite explicit that we're talking about the proper place of a trial. So in Daniels, the defendant conceded that we knew where all of his criminal behavior took place. Some was in Stearns County, some was in Hennepin County, but it was all known. There's no factual dispute there. And on appeal, because he didn't really have a sufficiency argument to make, what Mr. Daniels argued was, you tried me in the wrong place. That's why there's different law, Daniels, and that's why it doesn't apply here. This case has nothing to do with where the trial is held. That's not the issue that Mr. Lawson raises on appeal. Instead, the law that applies is Pierce, and that case is quite clear. It's about sufficiency. It defines the venue element. It uses the any element test. That's what should apply here. And under that test, the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the offenses occurred in Hennepin County. And for the same reason, because Daniels doesn't apply, that law is inapplicable, that would have been an erroneous jury instruction.
So counsel, it seems like I understand your argument that based on the case law, that venue with respect to jurisdiction by the court is a separate issue from venue with respect to an element of the crime. But it seems to me that the two still have a certain amount of overlap with each other. For example, if you can't prove that something was committed, a crime was committed in a particular venue, then the district court has no jurisdiction over that matter in the first instance. So while they are two separate and distinct concepts, the first one in terms of whether or not the district court decides venue, and I think there's some case law debating whether or not venue across the board should just be an issue of law that's decided by the court. And I think there's actually some logic to that. I've actually thought about that even, I recall thinking about that in law school, believe it or not, way back when. But it seems to me that if venue for whether or not the court has jurisdiction is a threshold issue, that almost becomes duplicated and kind of a given for the case itself in terms of whether or not that element is even required to be met, because hasn't the district court in essence already decided that issue?
Well, no, Your Honor, because we have different standards. So I would say this, that they are decided at different points in time. So the question of which county can hold a trial in which we apply Daniels has a broader standard. And I think that's sensible. It's sensible to give the government a little bit more leeway, a little bit more leniency in terms of the logistical question of where we hold a trial. That doesn't mean in any case when the district court has implicitly or explicitly found Daniels satisfied, found, for instance, the operative event or triggering event satisfied, that does not mean in every case that the state will be able to meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So here, I mean, here you could think of it as a good example. Even if the state satisfied the Daniels test about trial location by identifying an operative event or triggered in Hennepin County, it doesn't necessarily mean they can prove that any element occurred in Hennepin County. And I just want to hear.
I have a hypothetical question to get at what is concerning me about your argument. Let's assume that you had a kidnapping that occurred certainly in a particular county, and the kidnapping involved a woman being abducted, blindfolded, and then put into a van, and then driven somewhere for 3 hours, and then repeatedly sexually abused by multiple men, and then she's returned to the place, again blindfolded, the place where she was kidnapped. Am I correct in your understanding that the case, well, that there would be insufficient evidence to convict anywhere, at least on the sexual abuse, the sex assault charges, not the kidnapping, despite the fact that it is known and established where the kidnapping occurred?
Yes. That is the necessary implication of a system built upon proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a place like Minnesota, where we say that venue is an element. There will always be, just like any other element that the state cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt, even if everyone thinks a crime occurred, that necessarily means there's insufficient evidence.
So even if there's no dispute that a crime did occur, that basically we found a way to allow a person to commit a perfect crime. As long as you take them out of the county that they're originally in and commit a crime against a person, whether it's assault, whether it's rape, whether whatever it is, as long as they don't know that they've been transported to another county and they don't know where they're at, they're not going to be liable for that subsequent crime? That seems like an absurd result there.
Only where it is true that through law enforcement investigation, through any witnesses, not simply the victim, only in cases where the state cannot prove that any element took place in a certain county, like here. And I just want to go back.
I want to ask real quick, can you address Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 24.02 Subdivision 3? Because I don't think you addressed it in either one of your briefs, and that seems to really support the idea that Daniels should apply when you don't know exactly where a particular crime occurred, but you've got multiple crimes and the instigating crime at least has occurred in at least one county that is known, where venue with respect to actually trying the case is considered proper.
Certainly, Your Honor. And this actually brings back the point that I was hoping to make, which is, I just want to be clear, and I will address your question. This court has never, and no court in Minnesota, has ever held that Daniels is the standard for the venue element. Therefore, your question about the rule of criminal procedure, no, that establishes where a case can be tried. And again, in this court's own words, those are distinct concepts. One of them, the venue element, was addressed About 10 years ago in Pierce, this court didn't say anything about Daniels, certainly didn't apply Daniels, even though it was out there. So all of the rules, the special venue rules, which are in Rule 24.02, including Subdivision 3, that is solely about where to hold a trial. And that is not disputed. Mr. Lawson does not contest the location of his trial. So I would not dispute that that rule potentially allows a trial to be held in Hennepin County. It does not mean, because that logistical consideration is satisfied, that the state can meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not about burdens of proof. It's not about evidence. It's not about defining what venue as an element means. So it does not resolve this issue, Your Honor. I am almost out of time. I would just reiterate that Pierce is the law that's controlling here. Pierce adopted the any element test, and under that test, Mr. Lawson's convictions should be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Okay, I'm hoping my technology is working for you guys.
Yes,
may it please the court. My name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. And I agree with Ms. Yelk-Erickson. I do think that the dispute really is about what the appropriate law is on venue in this case. It's our position that that law is articulated in State versus Daniels and Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2402 Subdivision 3. And I'll start with Ms. Yelk-Erickson's argument that that case and those rules are just about the place where we have a trial. That's just a convenience issue. And we would strongly disagree with that for a number of reasons. One, the same way I can't or did not in my brief point to a case that says that Daniels applies in the specific context of jury instructions or a sufficiency claim, Ms. Yelk-Erickson can't point to a case that says it is error, much less clear or obvious error, for a district court to include this language about the operative events test in a jury instruction. And we are operating in the arena of plain error, and it isn't not my burden to prove Daniels doesn't or does apply. It's Ms. Yelk-Erickson's burden to prove that it is plain or obvious error.
Ms. Burdoff, what about her reference to our specific indication that venue for the purpose of trial location and venue for the purpose of an elemental test for proof beyond a reasonable doubt and sufficiency of the evidence are distinct concepts? Why isn't that sufficient to make the break that you're saying doesn't exist in Minnesota law?
Okay. I agree that there is case law in Minnesota that says the concept of where a case is venued and venue as an element are distinct. I don't think that they are distinct in the way that Ms. Yelk-Erickson has described, however. If you look closely at Daniels, what was argued in Daniels was that a strict elements test should be applied there, and that the state would have had to prove that some element of the criminal sexual conduct and the robbery that were at issue in that case occurred in Stearns County for the case to be venued there. The venue instruction in Daniels, if you go and you look at the district court record, actually, when the jury was instructed, they were instructed that the venue was Stearns County. And they were given a similar enough instruction to the one given in this case that I think Ms. Yelk-Erickson is making too narrow an argument about what Daniels means. I think that there is a number of different places where we look for authority about what the governing law is on venue. There's a constitutional provision, there's a statute that refers to an element of the offense, and then there's the criminal rule. It talks about I think the rule is the most helpful because it really gives us a list of sort of those special circumstances where venue is problematic. And this is one of those. I agree that generally we have to prove that a crime was committed in the county and where we are trying it and prosecuting it. That's generally true. I agree that oftentimes, and the jury here was instructed that they could convict if they found any element of the criminal sexual conduct charge occurred in Hennepin County. And I think there's a fair argument that they could have found Mr. Lawson guilty under the elements test. But there were also, you know, this is a different.
But they weren't presented with the option to do that because they weren't given an instruction to do that.
The jury instruction in this case said venue in Hennepin County is appropriate under two conditions. One, if an element of the crime occurred here, that's in the jury instruction. Or two, if the crime was set in, it was set in operation or triggered in Hennepin County. So it incorporates.
That's the difficulty I have. You're saying that the two approaches dovetail and that Pierce shouldn't be read so specifically. But it certainly makes sense that they would be different. If you had a crime that if you had multiple crimes, one of which occurred in Hennepin County, one in Stearns County, one in St. Louis County, it makes sense if it's a continuing crime that the case not have to be tried separately as to each one of the counts in the different counties. So in that case, it makes sense that a triggering event test would apply to determine where the case is heard. But that seems to be a separate question from the elemental issue, the sufficiency of the evidence, when in Minnesota, it is, and it's not disputed by the state, an element of the crime, the individual crimes, each one of the individual crimes would have to be proved to have occurred in the location, in a specific location. So I'm struggling with your position that these are two legal concepts that can always be merged in every circumstance.
And hopefully I can help you with that struggle, which is we are actually talking about a unique set of circumstances. And you identified it in your earlier hypothetical. This isn't a case where we know exactly where this criminal sexual conduct occurred. This is a case where the victim cannot say. I look at the facts and the sequence and the timings, and I think there's a pretty good argument that this actually happened in Hennepin County. Pretty good argument, right? But can we prove that beyond a reasonable doubt? No. But we also can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened in Ramsey County or Washington County. And the Minnesota Supreme Court anticipated a circumstance like this. They talk about it in Fitch, a case cited in my brief, and they talk about it in Norton, a case cited in my brief. And that is when you have a single course of conduct that spans multiple counties and involves a series of crimes, and it is doubtful where one of those crimes occurred. Your blindfold example is a perfect one. Then what the rule says, and the Supreme Court and Fitch recognized that this was a valid exception to our statutory law and the constitutional provision, is what the rule says. If it's doubtful, we know which counties were involved, where a specific crime occurred, then venue is going to be appropriate in any of those counties. So, and that's what's reflected in Daniels.
Venue to hear the case.
No, venue to prosecute the case. And this is where Norton becomes helpful. Norton is a case that was prosecuted by Hennepin County in Hennepin County that involved a kidnapping and a sexual assault of a little girl. She was 5. So she was snatched in Hennepin County out of a front yard. They found her hours later in Dakota County with the defendant. She was sexually assaulted, but she had absolutely no idea where that sexual assault happened. My office, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, did not prosecute that case. And the reason given was that we couldn't prove venue in Hennepin County for the sexual assault. In a footnote, it's footnote 1 in Norton, the Supreme Court was highly critical of that analysis by my office and went on at length about how where it's doubtful where a criminal act occurred, that can be prosecuted in any county where part of the criminal course, known county, where part of the criminal course of conduct happened. And they actually cite to Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2402 subdivision 3, which is the provision we're relying on. If these were really completely distinct concepts and one was just about location, and there's an entirely different concept that applies in these kinds of cases for the element test, Norton, the Supreme Court couldn't or wouldn't have dropped that footnote. I have another example, if it's helpful to you, which is there's a case that is actually cited in Fitch. It's cited in Daniels. It's called State versus, I think it's Krejci. It's K-R-E-C-J-I. And it's cited in all the cases that Ms. Yelk-Erickson and I cited in our briefs. And what that was is we have special venue statutes in Minnesota that address a lot of these different circumstances where venue is difficult to prove. One of those is child abuse cases. And the venue statute in Minnesota says you can prosecute where the crime occurred or where the child is found. And the reason the legislature created that is because oftentimes children, like the child in Norton, can't say where a crime occurred. They just aren't, they don't have the developmental capacity or ability to do that. In Krejci, the defense challenged the constitutionality of that statute, making an argument not unlike the one that Ms. Yelk-Erickson's making here. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, that is perfectly constitutional to venue, to prosecute a case where a child is found, even if the state cannot prove that that's where the sexual assault also occurred. And so again, if somehow the law was or should be different for proving an element and the location of trial in this limited kind of context where venue is difficult to prove, then Krejci also, I don't think, could have turned out the way it did turn out. I think there's also some agreement between Ms. Yelk-Erickson and I, which is this: if Daniels is an appropriate and accurate statement of the law, then it was correctly inserted. I mean, I don't really think we're disagreeing that the language that showed up in the jury instruction in this particular case was lifted from Daniels and is an accurate statement of the law as described in Daniels. So if this court decides that that iteration of venue in Daniels is an accurate statement of law, then I think it was appropriately included in the instruction, and it was appropriate for the jury to consider that when they were deciding whether or not Mr. Lawson was guilty. Again, if it's an accurate statement of the law and venue, I also think that it is appropriate for the sufficiency challenge. It is the measure against which we look at the evidence. And this is, I think, what the case law that talks about the element issue being distinct, it's distinct in this way, which is, this is the law on venue, this is where venue is appropriate. We have to present sufficient evidence to demonstrate that an operative event or triggering event occurred in Hennepin County. And here, I don't really think that we're disputing that that happened. KT was kidnapped here at gunpoint. She was assaulted. Her car was stolen. I mean, one of the arguments that I didn't make as clear as I wished in my brief really is about an element. Mr. Lawson was convicted of aiding and abetting a criminal.
Ms. Burdoff, we've lost your sound. Ms. Burdoff? Okay, yeah.
I have this call-in number right next to me.
No sweat.
And I shut off my email. I was so worried about noise happening that I literally shut every. I pulled out all the plugs in my office. So my apologies. I'm so sorry.
Not a problem. We okay. Can, Ms. Burdoff, just so you know, we can hear you and we can see you. There is just a slight delay in terms of what we see and what we hear from you. So we'll certainly make sure that we give you enough time to finish your thoughts before we have any questions.
Okay, I actually stopped talking before because I thought someone did have a question. Was I wrong about that?
No, I think we were stopping because we couldn't hear you anymore.
Got it.
Ms. Burdoff, though, I am going to take this opportunity to have you move to the heinous crime sure. elements, and in particular, the dangerous weapon statute. Are you able to point to evidence? Do you believe it's necessary that the jury be explained that during the sexual assaults, since that is the location of the elements, that in fact the threat occurred at that time with a weapon for that element to be appropriate?
No. I think that the case that controls the resolution of that dangerous weapons heinous element is an unpublished case from this court decided in 2017 called State versus Elmy. The argument in that case is exactly the argument that is made here, which is the state can't prove that element unless the gun is displayed or brandished or used during the course of the sexual assault. What this court said in Elmy was that's actually inserting language into the statute, and which is improper. What is required is that the defendant have a dangerous weapon, and I think there's a dispute that there was evidence Mr. Lawson had at least one gun that the victim saw, and then used or threatened to use that gun, dangerous weapon, to cause submission of the victim. And there's also adequate testimony in the record to support that component of the heinous element, because KT testified that this assault happened. She saw the gun being displayed in the waist, Mr. Lawson's waistband. That caused her to be very fearful. Just like in Elmy, she lost track of where that gun was during, you know, this driving around in the course of this criminal conduct. And, but always in her mind was the idea that she was going to submit, and she was fearful of resisting because she knew that Mr. Lawson had a weapon. That's exactly what happened in Elmy. And this court held that there was sufficient evidence based on those analogous facts to support the jury's finding on the heinous element. I can also touch briefly on the other element if the court wishes. I see that I have 25 seconds left. And so unless you have questions.
Ms. Rudolph, I do have one other question. I do actually want to go back to the case you're referencing, and I'm blanking out on the name of it. I don't know if it was the Norton case or the, is it the Norton case that had the footnote?
Yes, it is.
And in that footnote, doesn't that seem to be addressing venue in terms of jurisdiction, i.e. that the county could have brought the subsequent sex offense charge even if they didn't know exactly where it occurred in the first instance, based on both the statute and the rule?
That's correct. And I mean, what that is an acknowledgement from the Minnesota Supreme Court that there are going to be circumstances where we might not be able to prove precisely where a criminal sexual conduct occurred, but that under Rule 2403 and Minnesota Statute 62701, subdivision is 1 and 2, that you would have appropriate venue in Hennepin County in that case. So that is really this case with a slightly different set of facts. And what the Supreme Court is saying in that footnote is, Hennepin County, you could have prosecuted that sexual assault because venue could have been proved in Hennepin County. That isn't a strict elements test. I wanted to make one small point about Pierce, a case that Ms. Yoke Erickson is relying on. If you dig down into Pierce, the question was whether or not an element of the offense was met either in the location where an offending message was sent or where it was received. And this court, I think, correctly resolved that question as a matter of law. What was interesting to me about that case is this court cited Rule 2403 or 2402 Subdivision 3 to support its conclusion that the elements test is actually broader and has been broadened by case law. So I think also if you do a careful reading of Pierce, number one, it's a different factual circumstance because it wasn't doubtful where the criminal conduct occurred, but it certainly supports the idea that we have argued that venue, even when it is considered an element, it must be more broadly interpreted.
Well, to be clear, I mean, in Pierce, there was an order for protection issue. And in that case, the element either, we reasoned, could be established, the element of location could be established either based upon the receipt or the sending. So
yeah,
it's not really factually broader. You're saying we took a more legally broad approach.
That's exactly what I'm saying. The facts aren't the same because both operative events that could have constituted the crime in Pierce were known. This is a different fact pattern that is specifically addressed in Rule 2402, and that's the provision of the rule that we're invoking. And we think is represented by Daniel and made the jury instructions an accurate statement of law. I see my time is up and I don't want to take more of your time. We would ask that this court apply Daniels, apply Rule 2402 Subdivision 3. Those are the correct statements of the law and affirm Mr. Lawson's convictions and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burdoff. Ms. Yao-Garrickson, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd also like to start with Pierce. I disagree with Ms. Burdoff. I think that's reading a lot of subtext into an opinion that doesn't say any of the things she just mentioned. What it does say is the venue element is satisfied where the state proves any element occurred in the county. That's it. That's the test. And I think actually the facts in Pierce support the appellant here. So in Pierce, I agree. I think the parties all knew where the acts took place. And it was more of a case where the prosecutor made a mistake. The prosecutor simply didn't ask the witness, where were you when you got the message? And nonetheless reversed that conviction because there wasn't sufficient evidence. Here, there's a whole lot less evidence. There's no inkling of where this occurred. So if it was appropriate under the any element test, which is the only test that counts, to reverse the conviction in Pierce, where the facts were likely known, but inadvertently, mistakenly not elicited, certainly where the state can't prove it at all, it's also appropriate to reverse that conviction. Now, Sturdoff has essentially made policy arguments to this court about why you should apply Daniels where it's never been applied before, jury instructions that have never been seen before. All of it is okay because it would be bad to reverse this conviction. That's the subtext. This court didn't buy into that sort of argument in Pierce with, I think we would all probably agree, a far less egregious crime. The law is the law is the law, and we apply it to all sorts of cases from the mundane to the heinous and terrible, and that is what you should do here. Now, I also found it telling that Ms. Burdoff agreed, and I believe I'm getting this accurate, that generally the state has to prove that the charged offense occurred in the county of charging, but that the special venue rules create exceptions. Well, they do. They create exceptions for where a case can be tried. That is what they're about. Notably, there isn't one for criminal sexual conduct, and there isn't one that says when no one has any idea where the crime occurred, it can be tried in X county. The legislature could have created that. The legislature is actually quite active in creating these special venue rules. They created a new one after Smith, which was the murder that occurred in Wisconsin, but the body was found in Minnesota. And they, I believe, created a new addition after Pierce, where they said something about the calls and how you prove venue, trial location, despite a lack of evidence about where the calls were placed from.
Ms. Yao-Garrickson, as a broad proposition, if once it's determined that venue in terms of trial location is proper, does it not necessarily follow that therefore venue as an element is also proper?
Not unless you change the law. So if this court adopts Daniels as the standard for the venue element, sure, yes. But you haven't done that. Right now, we have two distinct bodies of law. This court has said explicitly and repeatedly that these concepts are distinct, used that word. And you have cases where each issue arises applying its own law, right? So Daniels is not really about the any element test. Daniels lists four things: operative event, triggering event, related to, part of. That's the Daniels test because that's about venue. Pierce, decided after Daniels, doesn't cite Daniels at all. Daniels isn't about sufficiency and Pierce is, and Pierce says any element. So under the law we currently have, it is not correct to say when a district court finds that a trial is properly venued in a county, that necessarily means the state can prove the element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ms. Yao-Garrickson, what about Norton and that footnote? Because Footnote one by the Minnesota Supreme Court, they really take the county to task. They say, yes, if it was an issue of you don't want to put the child through psychological turmoil, I think is the term used, of having to testify. That's one thing if you don't want to prosecute. But just because the child has no idea where the sexual abuse occurred, that is not an excuse for you to the county to bring that charge just because venue isn't known. As long as you know either where it started or ended, and in fact, they even talk about how if it's when it's doubtful, if it's in one of two or more counties, you can still prosecute that case. The Supreme Court talks about the rule of criminal procedure and statute and said they're consistent. And it seems to me that if they're saying there's no reason for you to why you should not prosecute that case just because you don't know venue in terms of the jurisdiction, why that wouldn't apply with respect to an element of the crime. It seems that the court is making it very clear that should not stop a person from being prosecuted for that crime.
I agree, Your Honor. I think we have to be very careful about the language. So anytime you say a person can be prosecuted, I don't disagree, because that's trial location. So what that footnote says is shame on you for not trying, for not prosecuting him. You should have brought charges. Let's keep in mind we're talking about a footnote in an opinion from 1982 that does not make law, does not say here's a brand new legal standard on the venue element, but is taking, I think, kind of an inappropriate personal shot at prosecutors for their charging decision in a case. What it does not say is they could have proven this offense beyond a reasonable doubt occurred in X county because here's the legal standard. That's just not what that footnote is all about.
Can I ask you an overarching question about Pierce, since you rely on that so heavily?
Yes.
There's been no other case published either in the Supreme Court or this court reestablishing that venue has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that correct?
As far as I know, yes, Your Honor.
Now, there's some language in Ali, which is a Supreme Court case, in which Justice Strauss said the following, and I'll quote. Ali contends that jurisdiction is no less indispensable to a conviction than is a fact establishing venue. And that is because the Court of Appeals has required that venue be proven by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt, citing State v. Pierce. And we should apply the beyond a reasonable doubt standard to jurisdiction as well. I found it interesting that the Supreme Court simply referred to the Pierce holding as the Court of Appeals has required, not that it is as a matter of law required. Does that not suggest to you that perhaps the Supreme Court hasn't bought into our Pierce holding?
Well, when phrased that way, Your Honor, have they not bought in? Maybe. Have they changed the law? Certainly not. Clearly, if that court wanted to say X cases, Pierce and others, are wrong, venue is not an element that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that was their opportunity to do so. They didn't. The verbiage, I grant you, is a little odd. Nonetheless, that is not any sort of retraction of decades of this court's case law.
Well, when you say decades, you mean decade, singular. I think it was 2010.
I'm not sure. Well, right, but there's cases before that. There's Blue Flat, there's Eibensteiner, there's Larson. So the enunciation of venue as an element predates Pierce. Pierce was the latest in the line of cases to say so. If this court has no further questions.
I have one last question, because ultimately, Ms. Burdoff mentioned the standard. And in fact, because there was no objection at trial to the jury instructions, for example, we're looking at this under the plain error standard. So for those elements to be met, there has to be an error, and that error has to be plain. In other words, it has to contravene some type of case law.
Yes.
And it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that there's not actually any clear case law as to the language of set into motion or operative or trigger an event as applied to the venue element. Is am I understanding your argument right? In other words, Daniels doesn't apply. So I mean, I'm struggling a little bit with how, even if we assume that there's error, let's assume for the sake of argument there is error. Mm-hmm. How is it plain if there isn't some case law or statute or rule that has established that when you're talking about venue, you cannot instruct a jury using the Daniels test?
Sure, Your Honor. So perhaps a hypothetical would be helpful. Let's assume for the sake of my hypothetical that the any element test is the proper test and there's a trial and the any element facts are maybe a little bit unclear and the district court decides to instruct the jury. Venue is proven beyond a reasonable doubt when the defendant resides in the county of charging. That's just not the law. That has never been the law. And that has to be plain error. Just because we don't have a case saying if a district court instructs the jury that venue is established where the defendant resides, that's plain error. I've never understood the logic of saying something cannot be plain until we have a case saying it is. I don't think that's correct. I think when you
I think I would disagree with you there, because actually the Supreme Court reversed me on that very issue recently when we had issued an opinion a month before my unpublished opinion came out, and they said I was wrong because there was the case law was unsettled on that very point. Now they eventually actually adopted the position that I took, so I lost the war, but I won the battle. But the Supreme Court is very, very clear on the Zinsky case, in the Zinsky case, that it has to contravene case law. And if case law is unsettled on an issue, it cannot be error. I'm sorry, it cannot be plain error. The error cannot be plain. It doesn't meet the plain element or the plain error test.
I would say this, Your Honor. I'm moderately familiar with Zinsky, and I think on that issue, the sort of sua sponte giving of instructions, that was truly unsettled. There were cases, published cases going either way. That is not the case here.
Well, there are three sets of published cases from our court, and then the case that came out right before my case said, well, I'm not so sure about it. And they actually relied on that to say that created made it unsettled, even though it was clearly, it had been clearly settled for decades before that.
I understand, Your Honor. I would say we don't even have that here. We have venue element law applying to questions of the venue element, and we have trial location law applying in cases that challenge trial location. They have never been conflated. There has never been a case applying one to the other. So it's clear error because it contravenes the consistent, repeated statements that this is the law, not this. And I would say that is plain error in this case. I would ask this court to reverse Mr. Lawson's convictions for insufficient evidence and also for erroneous jury instructions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Judge Ross, Judge Sleater, any additional follow-up questions? Okay. Ms. Burdoff, Ms. Erickson, thank you very much for your arguments and your briefing. As always, both of you are representing your clients very, very well and the citizens of the state of Minnesota. We really appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe, which in this case will be 90 days. Both of you, please be safe. And that that takes care of our cases for the oral argument. Court is now in recess. Thank you very much.